content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Welcome to the New Yorker Hour on the Triangle Radio Reading Service. I'm Evan Mercer, and today, from the March 18, 2019 edition of the New Yorker magazine, I will read a short story by Sally Rooney and an article about how one paint company is creating a new kind of decorating anxiety. I'll begin today with a short story from the fiction section entitled Color and Light by Sally Rooney. The first time he sees her, she's getting into his brother's car. He's sitting in the back seat and she gets into the front, closing the passenger door behind her. Then she notices him. She cranes around, eyebrows raised, and then turns back to Declan who says, "Who's this?" "Oh, that's Aiden," Declan says, "my brother." "I didn't know you had a brother," she smiles mildly. She turns around again, as if accepting the inevitability of having to speak to him. "Older or younger?" she asks. "Me?" Aiden says. "Younger." The interior of the car is dark, and she narrows her eyes before concluding, "You look it." "He's only a year younger," Declan says. The woman has turned away now to roll down her window. She has to wind it down using the small lever on the door. "Your parents were busy," she remarks. "How many others are there?" "Only us," Declan says. "They got it all out of the way quickly then," she says. "Sensible." Declan pulls out of the parking space and back onto the main road. Cool night air floods through the open window. The woman is lighting a cigarette. Aiden can see only the back of her head and her left arm, elbow angled. "I'll drop this lad off and then we'll go for a spin," Declan says. "Sounds divine," the woman says. On the right is a row of houses and shops, which tapers off as they reach the end of town. The caravan park, the golf links. Does a woman already know where Aiden lives? She doesn't seem curious about how long it will take to get there. She exhales smoke out of the window, and the surface of the golf course glitters darkly. "What do you do, Aiden?" she asks after a minute or two. "I work in a hotel." "Oh, how long have you been there?" "Few years," he says. "Do you like it?" "It's all right." She flicks the stub of her cigarette out the window and rolls the window up. The car is much quieter then, and things seem to hang unspoken. Declan says nothing. Aiden bites gently at the rough side of his left thumbnail. Should he ask her what she does for a living? But he doesn't even know her name. And as if apprehending this very problem, Declan says, "Pauline is a writer." "Oh," Aiden says. "What kind of things do you write?" "Films," she says. For some reason, Aiden does not wish to seem surprised by this knowledge, though he doesn't think he's ever been in a car with a screenwriter before. He just smiles and makes a noise like, "Huh?" as if to say, "Well, there you are." The woman, whose name is apparently Pauline, unexpectedly swivels around to look at him. Her hair, he notices, is pulled back from her forehead by a wide velveteen band. She has a strange smile on her face. "What?" she says. "You don't believe me?" He is alarmed, feeling that he has offended her and that Declan will be angry with him later. "Of course I believe you," he says. "Why wouldn't I?" For a few seconds she says nothing, but in the darkness and silence of the car she looks at him. In fact, she stares at him right into his eyes for 2 or 3 seconds without speaking. Maybe even 4 full seconds, a very long time. Why is she looking at him like this? Her face is expressionless. She has a pale forehead and her lips are pale, so her mouth appears as one delicate line. Is she looking at him just to show him her face, the face of a screenwriter? When she speaks, her voice sounds totally different. She simply says, "Okay." And she stops looking at him and turns around. She doesn't speak to him again for the rest of the journey. She and Declan start talking instead about people and events that have nothing to do with Aiden. He listens to them as if they are performing a play, and he is the only audience member. Declan asks her when she's heading off to Paris, and she tells him. She takes out her phone and starts looking for a photograph to show him. He says that someone called Michael never got back to him about something, and Pauline says, "Oh, Michael will be there, don't worry." Outside the windows, the darkness is punctuated only by passing headlights, and far up in the hills, the flickering lights of houses, hidden and revealed through the leaves of trees. Aiden has a feeling of some kind, but he doesn't know what the feeling is. Is he annoyed? Why should he be? Declan indicates left for the estate. The street lights grow brighter as they approach, and then the world is populated again, with semi-detached houses and wheelie bins and parked cars. Declan pulls up outside Aiden's house. "Thanks for the list," Aiden says. "Have a good night." Pauline doesn't look up from her phone. He sees her again a few weeks later in the hotel. She comes in one night for dinner with a group of people Aiden has never seen before. She's not wearing a hairband this time. Her hair is fixed quite high on her head with a clasp. But it's definitely the same woman. Aiden brings a carafe of water to the table. Pauline is talking and everyone else is listening to her, including the men, some of whom are old and wearing suits. And they all seem fascinated by her. How unusual, Aiden thinks, to see grown men hanging on the words of a girl in that way. He wonders if she is famous or somehow important. When he fills her glass, she looks up and says thank you, and then she frowns. "Do I know you?" she says. Everyone at the table turns to stare at Aiden. He feels flustered. "I think you know my brother," he says, "Declan." She laughs, as if he had said something very charming. "Oh, you're Declan Kearney's brother," she says. And then turning to her friend, she adds, "I told you I knew all the locals." They laugh appreciatively. She doesn't look at Aiden again. He finishes filling the glasses and goes back to the bar. At the end of the night, he helps Pauline's party to get their coats from the cloakroom. It's after midnight. They all seem a little drunk. Aiden still can't tell what they are to one another. Friends? Colleagues? Family? The men are watching Pauline, and the other women are talking and laughing amongst themselves. Pauline asks him to call some taxis for them, and he goes behind the desk and picks up the phone. She places a hand delicately on the counter near the bell. "We're going to have some drinks at my house," she says. "Would you like to join us?" Aiden says, "No, I can't." She smiles pleasantly and turns back to her friends. Aiden dials the taxi number, gripping the phone hard against his skull so the ringtone shrieks in his ear. "Ah, he should have said thanks at least. Why didn't he? He was preoccupied, wondering where her house was. She can't live in town, or he would know her. Maybe she just moved to town, or maybe she's working on a new film. If she even really writes films." And he should have paused for a second to think about her question. And then he would have remembered to thank her. On the phone, he orders two taxis and then hangs up. "They'll be here shortly," he says. Pauline nods without looking back at him. He has made her dislike him. "I didn't know you lived around here," he says. Again, she just nods. He has the same view of her now as he did in the car the other week, the back of her head and her neck and shoulders. When the taxis arrive outside, she says without turning to him, "Give Declan my best." And then they all leave. Afterward, the waiter who cleared their table tells Aiden they left a huge tip. A few days later, he's working the front desk in the afternoon, and a queue forms while he's on the phone. When he hangs up, he apologizes for the wait. Checks the guests out of their rooms, wipes their key cards, and then sits down on the wheelie chair. Guests really don't have to do that, wait to be checked out. They can just leave their key cards on the desk and walk off without the formal goodbye, but Aiden supposes they want to get the official go-ahead to have their departure acknowledged in some way. Or maybe they just don't know that they're allowed and assume they're not without being told so, because after all, at heart, human beings are so extremely submissive. He taps his fingers on the desk in a little rhythm, distracted. Declan and Aiden are in the process of selling their mother's house. Declan has a house of his own already, a smaller one, closer to town, with a 20-year mortgage. People thought Aiden might move back into the old house, seeing as he's renting outside town and has to share with housemates, but he doesn't want to. He just wants to get rid of the place. Their mother was sick for a long time, though she wasn't old, and he loved her very much. So it's painful to think of her now. And in fact, he tries not to think of her. The thought creates a feeling. The thought might at first be only an abstract idea or a memory, but a feeling follows on from it helplessly. He would like to be able to think of her again, because she was the only person on earth who loved him most. But it isn't yet possible to do so without pain. Maybe it never will be. In any case, it's not as if the pain goes away when he doesn't think of her. A pain in your throat may get worse when you swallow, maybe almost unbearably painful when you swallow, but that doesn't mean that the pain is gone when you're not swallowing. Yes, life is full of suffering, and there's no way to be free of it. Anyway, they're selling the house, and Aiden will come into a little money, though not a lot. That night, Declan comes to pick him up from work very late, after 2 a.m, and Pauline is lying in the back of the car, apparently drunk. "Ignore her," Declan says.
"Don't ignore me," Pauline says. "How dare you?"
"How is work?" Declan asks. Aiden closes the door and puts his bag down at his feet. "Okay," he says. The car smells of alcohol. Aiden still feels that he doesn't really know who this woman is, this woman lying on the back seat. She's coming up fairly often in his life at this point, but who is she? At first, he thought she was Declan's girlfriend, or at least a candidate for that role. But then in the hotel the other night, she seemed different, glamorous in a way, with all those men looking at her. And of course, Declan wasn't there, and she even invited Aiden over for a drink afterward. He could ask his brother, "How do you know this girl? I mean, are you riding her or what?" But Declan's sensibilities would be offended by that kind of thing. "How would you get home if you didn't have a lift?" Pauline says.
"Walk," Aiden says.
"How long would it take?"
"About an hour."
"Is it dangerous?"
"What?" Aiden says. "No, it's not dangerous."
"Dangerous in what way?"
"Ignore her," Declan repeats.
"Aiden is my good friend," Pauline says. "He won't ignore me. I left him a very generous tip in his restaurant, didn't I?"
"I heard about that," he says. "That was nice of you."
"And I invited him to my house," she continues, "only to be cruelly rebuffed."
"What do you mean you invited him to your house?" Declan asks. "When was this?"
"After dinner at the hotel," she says, "and he rebuffed me cruelly."
Aiden's face is hot.
"Well, I'm sorry you felt that way," he says. "I can't just walk out of work because someone invites me to their house."
"I didn't get an invite," Declan says.
"Well, you were busy," Pauline says, "and so was your brother, obviously. Can I ask you something about your job, Aiden?"
"What?" he says.
"Have you ever slept with any of the hotel guests?"
"For Christ's sake, Pauline," Declan says.
They are driving past the caravan park now, where the smooth, curved roofs of the caravans glow with reflected moonlight, white like fingernails. Beyond that, Aiden knows is the ocean. But he can't see or smell or even hear it now, sealed up inside the car with Pauline laughing and the air smelling of alcohol and perfume. Doesn't she know that Declan doesn't enjoy that kind of banter? Or maybe she does know and she's aggravating him on purpose for some reason Aiden doesn't understand.
"Don't listen to her," Declan says.
A car flashes past and disappears. Aiden turns around to look at her.
From this angle, her face is sideways. It's actually quite long and oval, like the shape of a headache pill.
"You can tell me," she says. "You can whisper."
"You're flirting with him," Declan says. "You're flirting with my brother right in front of me, in my car." He reaches out and punches Aiden on the arm. "Stop looking at her," he says. "Turn around now. You're messing and I don't like it."
"Well, who were all these people in the hotel the other night?" Aiden says. "Were they your friends?"
"Just people I know."
"Well, they seemed like big fans of yours."
"People only act like that when they want something from you," she says.
She lets him continue staring at her. She lies there absorbing his look, even smiling vaguely, allowing it to go on.
Declan punches him again. Aiden turns around. The windshield is blank like a powered-off computer screen.
"We're not allowed to sleep with the guests," he says.
"Well, no, of course not, but I bet you've had offers."
"Well, yeah, well, mostly from men."
Declan appears startled.
"Really?"
he says. Aiden just shrugs.
Declan has never worked in a hotel or a bar or a restaurant. He's an office manager with a business degree.
"Are you ever tempted?" Pauline says.
"Not usually." Aiden touches the window handle on the car door, not winding it up or down, just toying with it.
"We did have a writer in the other night who invited me back to her house," he says.
"Was she beautiful?"
"Pauline," Declan says, "you're pissing me off now. Just drop it, okay? Jesus, this is the last time I do you a favor."
Aiden can't tell if Declan is still speaking to Pauline now or to him.
It sounded like he meant Pauline, but Aiden is the one receiving the favor of a lift home, not her. Unless there's another favor running concurrently to this one.
Everyone falls silent. Aiden thinks about the linen room at work, where all the clean sheets are stored, folded up tight in the wooden slats, bluish white, smelling of powder and soap. When they pull up outside his house, he thanks his brother for the lift. Declan makes a dismissive gesture in the air with his hand.
"Don't worry about it," he says.
The shape of Pauline's face is visible through the back window, but she is looking at him, or not. He can't tell.
2 weeks later, the arts festival is on in town and the hotel is busy. Aiden's manager has to call him in for an extra shift on Friday because one of the girls has laryngitis. He finishes work at 10 on Saturday night and goes down to the seafront for the closing ceremony of the festival. It's the same every year, a fireworks display at the end of the pier. He's seen the display 10 or 12 times now, or however many years the festival has been going. The first time, he was a teenager, still in school. He thought that his life was just about to start happening then. He thought that he was poised tantalizingly on the brink, and that any day, or even any minute, the waiting would end and the real thing would begin. Down on the beach, he zips his jacket up to the chin. It's crowded already, and the street lights on the promenade cast a gray glow over the sand and the sea. Families pick their way down the beach with buggies, bickering or laughing, and boats clink in the marina, a noise like handbells ringing, but random and disconnected. Teenagers sit on the steps, drinking cans and laughing at videos. People from the festival hold walkie-talkies to their ears and stride around importantly. Aiden looks at his phone, wondering if Declan is around or Richie or any of the gang from work, but no one said anything in that group chat. It's cold again this year. He puts his phone away and rubs his hand. Pauline is already walking toward him by the time he sees her, meaning she has seen him first. She's wearing a big, oversized fleece that drops down almost to her knees. Her hair is pushed back from her forehead by a hairband again. "So, you do have days off," she says.
"I actually just finished," he says, "but I'm off tomorrow."
"Can I watch the fireworks with you, or are you with someone?"
He immediately likes this question. Turning it over in his mind only seems to reveal additional angles from which it can be admired.
No, I'm on my own, he says. We can watch together, yeah.
She stands beside him, rubs her arms in a pantomime of being cold. He looks at her, wondering if the pantomime demands some kind of response from him.
I'm sorry I was such a mess the other day, she says. When was that?
Last week or whenever? I think Declan was annoyed afterward.
Was he?
Did he say anything to you about it?
Me? No, Aiden says. We don't really talk about things.
The lights overhead go down, and the beach is in darkness. Around them, people are moving, huddling, saying things, taking out their phones and shining torches. And then at the end of the pier, the fireworks begin. A line of golden sparks shoots upward into the sky and ends in a colored point. First pink, then blue, then pink again, casting its brief hypnotic light on the sand and the water. Then a whistling noise, as low as a breath, and above them in the sky, exploding outward, red blossoms and yellow and then green, leaving soft fronds of gold behind. When the fireworks burst, it's silent color and light at first, and a second later, the noise, a loud crack like something breaking, or a deep, low booming that goes into the chest. Aiden can see the tiny missiles flying upward, hissing into the sky from the pier, almost invisible, and then shattering outward into the fragments of light, glittering like pixels, bright white fading to yellow, and then gold to darker gold, and then black. It's the darker gold, just before black, that he finds most beautiful, a low ember color, darker than a glowing coal. Finally, so high above, they have to crane their necks to see the whole shape, three dazzling yellow fireworks consuming the sky, eating the whole darkness. Then it's over. The street lights come back up. Beside him, Pauline is rubbing her face and nose with her hands. Cold again, Aiden realizes obscurely, that a lot depends on now on Pauline's having enjoyed the fireworks. That if she didn't enjoy them, if she thought they were boring, not only will he no longer like her, but he will no longer have enjoyed them either, in retrospect, and something good will be dead. He says nothing. Along with everyone else, they turn back and leave the beach. It's possible to walk at only one speed, the speed of the crowd, which seems like the slowest and least comfortable speed at which humans can move. And at this pace, Aiden keeps bumping into people. Small children keep running out unexpectedly in front of him, and prams and people in wheelchairs need to move past. Pauline stays close by him, and at the top of the promenade, she asks if he'll walk her home. And he says, sure. She's staying in one of the houses on the seafront. He knows the street. It's where all the holiday homes are, with glass walls facing the ocean. As they walk, the rest of the crowd falls away behind them. When they reach her street, it's just the two of them alone, in silence. There's so much he doesn't know about Pauline. So much. It strikes him with a different and slightly surprising emphasis that he would like to know. That it's impossible to begin to asking questions. He doesn't know her surname or where she's from, what she does all day, who her family are. He doesn't know how old she is or how he came to know Declan or how well she knows him. You know, as to what you were saying the other night, Aiden says, I actually did sleep with a guest at the hotel once. I wouldn't go telling Declan about it because he doesn't approve of that kind of thing. Pauline's eyes flashed up at him.
Oh, who was the guest, she asked.
I don't know, a woman staying on her own. She was a little bit older, maybe in her 30s.
And it was a good experience or bad?
Oh, it was great, Aiden says. It wasn't great, Aiden says. Not that the sex was bad, but more that I felt bad about it, like it was the wrong thing to do.
But the sex was good?
It was okay. I mean, I'm sure it was fine. I don't even remember it now. Something at the time made me think maybe she was married, but I don't know for a fact. I just thought it at the time.
Why did you do it?
Pauline says.
He goes quiet for a few seconds.
I don't know, he says. I was hoping you wouldn't ask that.
What do you mean?
Well, you just seem like someone who understands these things, but when you ask that, it makes me feel like I did something weird.
She stops walking and puts her hand on a gatepost, which must be hers. He stops walking, too. Behind her is a large house with big windows, set back from the street by a garden, and all the lights are switched off.
Well, I don't think it's weird, she says. I used to have a boyfriend who was married. And I knew his wife, not well or anything, but I didn't know her.
I mean, I'm not asking you why you did it because I think it's sick that you would sleep with someone who was married. I suppose I just wonder, why do we do things that we don't really want to do? And I thought you might have an answer. But it's okay. If you don't, I don't either.
Right. Well, that makes me feel better. Not that I'm happy you were in a bad situation, but I feel better that I'm not the only one.
Are you in a bad situation now?
No, he says. Now I would say I am in no situation at all. I feel like my life basically isn't happening. I think if I dropped dead, the only people who would care are the people who would have to cover my shifts. And they wouldn't even be that sad. They'd just be annoyed.
Pauline frowns. She rubs the gatepost under her hand like she's thinking.
Well, I don't have a problem with that.
Excuse me. Well, I don't have that problem, she says. I think in my case, there's too much happening. At this point, everyone I've ever met seems to want something from me. I feel like if I dropped dead, they'd probably cut my body into pieces and sell it at an auction.
You mean like those people you were with at the hotel?
She shrugs. She rubs her arms again. She asks him if he wants to come inside, and he says yes. The house is spacious, and though furnished appears curiously empty. The ceilings are high up and far away. Pauline leaves the keys on the hall table and walks through the house, switching lights on in a seemingly arbitrary fashion. They reach the living room, and she sits down on a gigantic green corner sofa with a flat surface so large it resembles a bed, but with cushions at the back. There is no television, and the bookshelves are bare. He sits down on the couch, but not right beside her.
Do you live here on your own?
He says. She looks around vaguely, as if she doesn't know what he means by here.
Oh, she says, well, only for now.
Well, how long is now?
Everyone always asks questions like that. Don't you start. Everyone wants to know what I'm doing and how long I'm doing it for. I'd like to be really alone for a while and for no one to know where I was or when I was coming back. And maybe I wouldn't come back at all.
She stands up from the sofa and asks if he would like a drink. Unnerved by her previous speech about going somewhere alone and never returning, which seems in a way like a metaphor, he just shrugs.
I have a bottle of whiskey, she says.
But I don't want you to think I have a drinking problem. Someone gave it to me as a present. I didn't buy it myself.
Would you even have a small half glass and I'll have one? But if you don't want one, I won't have one either.
Okay, I'll have a glass, yeah, he says. She walks out of the room. Not through a door, but through an open archway. The house is confusingly laid out, so he can't tell where she's gone or how far away.
If you want to be alone, she says aloud, I can go.
Excuse me. If you want to be alone, he says aloud, I can go. She appears in the archway almost instantly.
What? She says.
If you want to be alone, like you were saying, he repeats, I don't want to intrude on you.
Oh, I only meant that philosophically, she says.
Were you listening to me? That's your first mistake. Everything I say is nonsense. Your brother knows how to deal with me. He never listens. I'll be back in a second.
She goes away again.
What does it mean that Declan knows how to deal with Pauline? Should Aiden ask? Maybe this is his opening to ask. She returns with two half-full tumblers, hands him one, and then settles down on the sofa beside him, slightly closer than where she had been sitting previously, though still not touching. They sip the whiskey. It's not something Aiden would ever drink on his own volition, but it tastes fine. I'm sorry about your mother, Pauline says. Declan told me that she passed away.
Yeah, thanks. They pause. Aiden takes another large sip of whiskey.
You're seeing a lot of Declan, are you? He says.
Well, he's sort of my car friend. I mean, he's my only friend who has a car. He's very nice. He's always driving me places. And he usually just ignores me when I say silly things. I think he thinks I'm a terrible woman. He wasn't impressed with me the other night when I asked you those vulgar questions, but you're his baby brother. He thinks you're very innocent.
Aiden pays special attention to the fact that she used the word friend more than once in connection with Declan. He feels it can have only one meaning, a thought that makes him feel good.
Does he? He replies. I don't know what he thinks of me.
He said he didn't know if you were gay or straight, Pauline says.
Well, as I said, I don't talk about things with him.
You've never brought a girlfriend home.
Well, you've got the advantage on me here, Aiden says. He's telling you all about me, and I don't know anything about you.
She smiles. Her teeth are extremely white. Perfect. Unrealistic looking. Almost blue.
What do you want to know? She says.
Well, I'm curious about what brings you to live here. I don't think you're from here.
That's what you're curious about? Good grief. I'm starting to think you really are innocent.
That's not very nice, Aiden says. She looks wounded for a moment, stares into her glass, and says sadly,
What made you think I was nice?
He doesn't think he can answer this question. In truth, he doesn't think of her as particularly nice. He just thinks of niceness as a general standard to which everyone accepts they can be held. She puts her empty glass down on the coffee table and sits back on the couch.
Your life isn't as bad as you think it is, she says.
Well, neither is yours, he replies.
How should you know?
Everyone wants your attention all the time. So what? Aiden says.
If you hated it so much, you could go off somewhere else on your own. What's to stop you?
She tilts her head to one side, places a hand gently under her chin.
Move to a remote seaside town, you mean? She says. Live the quiet life, maybe settle down with a nice country boy who works hard for a living. Is that what you had in mind?
Oh, get over it. She gives a light, irritatingly musical laugh.
I don't want anything from you, he adds.
Then what are you doing here?
He puts his glass down. You asked me to come in, he says. You asked me if we could watch the fireworks together, remember? And then you asked me to walk home with you, and then you asked me inside. And I'm the one who's inserting myself into your life, am I? I never wanted anything from you.
She seems to consider this, looking grave. Finally, she says, I thought you liked me.
What does that mean? If I liked you, that means something bad about me?
As if she had not heard him, she replies, I liked you.
Now, he feels utterly confused as to why they seem to be arguing, confused to the point of abrupt despair. Right here, he says, look, I'm going to go.
By all means.
He experiences this parting with her, this parting he himself announced spontaneously and called into existence as an excruciating ordeal, almost a physical pain. He can't quite believe he's going through with it, actually standing upright from the sofa and turning away toward the door they entered through. Why is everything so strange now? At what point did this relations with Pauline begin to violate the ordinary rules of social contact? It started normally enough, or did it? He still doesn't even know if she's his brother's girlfriend.
She doesn't rise from the couch to see him out. He has to make his way through the half-lit, cavernous house alone, fumbling through dark hallways and at one point a dazzlingly bright dining room toward the front door. Why did she say that about settling down with a, quote, nice country boy? She was just trying to provoke him. But why? She knows nothing about his life. Why is he even thinking about her then? At this moment, reaching the front door of Pauline's house, with its glazed glass reflecting back at him an unrecognizable image that he knows to be his own face, this strikes Aiden as the question without an answer. Several weeks later, he's in the back room trying to find a Continental power adapter for a guest upstairs when Lydia comes in saying that someone at reception wants him. "Wants what?" he says. "Wants you," Lydia says. "They're asking for you." Aiden closes the drawer containing the hotel's selection of adapters, and, as if in a dream now or in a video game, his actions under the control of some higher intelligence, he stands up and follows Lydia out of the back room toward the front desk. He already knows, before he sees or hears Pauline, that she will be there waiting for him. And she is. She's wearing a dress made from what looks like very soft, fine cloth. An older man is standing beside her with his arm around her waist. Aiden simply notices all this neutrally. His image of Pauline is already so confused and obscure that to see her in this situation cannot indicate anything really new about her. "All right," Aiden says. "How can I help?" "We're looking for a room," the man says. Pauline touches her nose with her fingertips. The man swats her arm and says, "You're making it worse. Look, it's going to start bleeding again." "It is bleeding," she says. She sounds drunk. Aiden can see that her fingers are bloodied when she draws them away from her face. He bends over the computer at the desk, but does not immediately open the room reservations interface. He swallows and pretends to click on something, actually just clicking nothing. Is Lydia watching him? She's at the desk, just a little way to his right, but he can't tell if she's looking. "For how many nights?" Aiden says. "One," the man says. "Tonight." "They're not going to have anything at such short notice," Pauline says. "Well, let's see," the man says. "Well, if you told me you were coming, I could have arranged something," she says. "Relax," the man says. Aiden swallows again. He's conscious of a kind of throbbing sensation inside his head, like the flicking of a light on and off. He moves the mouse around the screen in a show of efficiency and then, impulsively, pretends to type something, although there is no keyboard input, open on screen. He's certain Lydia's watching him. Finally, he straightens up from the computer and looks at the man. "No, I'm sorry," he says. "We don't have any rooms available tonight." The man stares at him. Lydia's looking over at him, too. "You don't have any rooms," the man says. "Every room in the hotel is taken in the middle of April?" "I told you," Pauline says. "Sorry," Aiden says. "We can't get you something until next week, if you'd like." The man moves his mouth like he's laughing, but no laugh comes out. He removes his hand from Pauline's waist, lifts it up in the air, and lets it drop down against his body. Aiden is careful not to look at Pauline or Lydia at all. "No rooms?" the man repeats. "All booked up? This hotel?" "I'm sorry, I can't help," Aiden says. The man looks at Pauline. "Well, what do you want me to do?" she says. In response, the man lifts his arm again to point at Aiden. "Is this your boyfriend?" the man says. "Oh, don't be absurd," Pauline says. "Are you going to develop paranoia now on top of everything else?" "You know him," the man says. "You asked for him." Pauline shakes her head, dabs delicately at her nose, and flashes a kind of apologetic smile at Aiden and Lydia across the desk. "I'm sorry," she says. "We'll get out of your way. Can I ask you to call a couple of taxis? I'd really appreciate."
"Oh, we can't share a taxi?" the man says.
Coldly now, Pauline replies. "We're going in opposite directions." Under his breath, with a kind of frozen grin on his face, the man says, "I don't believe it. I don't believe it." And then he turns around and walks toward the large double doors of the hotel entrance. Lydia picks up the phone to call the taxi company. Pauline, without any change in her demeanor, lifts the hotel pen from the desk, takes the pad of paper, writes something down, and then tears the sheet from the pad. She takes out some money, encloses it in the note, and pushes it across the desk toward Aiden. Looking only at Lydia, she smiles and says, "Thanks so much." And then she exits,
following the man through the double doors. When the door swings shut, Lydia is still on the phone. Aiden sits down and stares into space. He hears Lydia saying goodbye, and then he hears the faint click of the receiver replaced in its cradle. He just sits there. Lydia finds the note on the desk and nudges it in Aiden's direction with the end of a pen, like she doesn't want to touch it. "She left this for you," Lydia says. "I don't want it." Lydia uses the pen to flick open the note. There's a hundred euro in here, she says. "That's okay," says, "you take it." For a few seconds, Lydia says nothing. Aiden just sits staring blankly straight ahead. Presently, as if making up her mind, Lydia says, "I'll put it with the tips. She wrote you a note as well. Do you want that?" "I think it just says thank you." "You can leave it," he says. "Or actually give it to me." Lydia gives it to him. Without looking at it, he places it in his pocket, and then he rises from the chair to return to the back room to find the power adapter for the guest room upstairs. He won't see Pauline again before she leaves town in a few days' time. And now, from the Annals of Design section, an article entitled "The Perfect Paint, Farrow and Ball's Selective Palette is Creating a New Kind of Decorating Anxiety" by Rebecca Mead. Note, this article has been edited for length to fit for this broadcast. When Haley Allman and her husband bought an Edwardian row house in Kensal Rise, a hip neighborhood in northwest London, Allman knew exactly how she didn't want it to look. Her previous home, painted with white walls, had come to seem as sterile as an Apple store. Skylights in the kitchen made the brightness almost oppressive. "It felt like you were in a greenhouse," Allman recalled. "I was like a vampire trying to get away from the sun." Allman, who used to work in fashion and is now a perinatal mental health worker, wanted to step across her threshold and feel as if she were entering a candlelit set from a BBC period drama. Allman browsed Pinterest for expressive, richly hued rooms and messaged strangers on Instagram. "Where did that lovely sage green paint come from? What shade of purple was that front door?" She bought dozens of tester pots, daubing walls and window frames, but there were thousands of color options available and thousands of ways to make an embarrassing mistake. Allman was beginning to feel lost until an acquaintance gave her a tip. "You need to talk to Joa." Joa Studholm is the color curator for Farrow and Ball, the high-end English paint company, and she regularly offers private color consultations. Nobody is more confident in discriminating among minute gradations of white or in deciding between a greenish blue and a bluish green. She resolves perplexing baseboard issues with aplomb. Crucially, she provides her clients with limited options. Whereas Benjamin Moore offers 174 shades of red, the current Farrow and Ball palette offers 19. The selectiveness also lends status. The attuned eye immediately recognizes a Farrow and Ball red, such as Incarnadine or Blazer. Studholm charges clients about $320 an hour. On average, they require 2 hours of her attention. She also develops new colors for the company. Although many popular Farrow and Ball tones are neutrals, the company is most associated with deep shades. Its most recognizable colors, such as Stiff Key Blue, named for a beach in Norfolk, or Rectory Red, named for parsonages past, resemble those favored in former centuries to hide the stains of oil lamps or pipe smoke. For similar reasons, the ceilings of Victorian pubs are traditionally painted with a dark gloss. Such colors are a repudiation of the stark Scandinavian aesthetic, the tyranny of IKEA that has dominated interior design in recent decades. The company is known for the originality of its names, which are cunningly vivid even for its most bleary shades. Elephant's Breath, which might otherwise be described as taupe, far
outsells less excitingly named grays. Faro and Ball often draws inspiration from the natural world. Dead salmon is a dark pinkish brown. Mizzle, a gray-green, gets its name from a colloquialism for that familiar British weather condition halfway between mist and drizzle. A favored Faro and Ball trick is to take a simple word and translate it into French. A shade of brown that reminded the design team of a pair of pants became pantalon, and a crisp white is named chemise. A musty blue is de Nîmes, after the French city that invented denim. Some names are proudly perverse. One off-white shade is called blackened. Among devotees, Faro and Ball paint is believed to offer an unparalleled depth of color and a capacity for subtle, handsome transformation under different light conditions. For homeowners who lack the visual discernment to appreciate the way their mizzled kitchen cabinets turn from gray to green between sunrise and sunset, reassurance can be found in the product's premium price. Faro and Ball paints cost about $110 per gallon, almost twice the price of an ordinary brand. Using the paint confirms both a customer's fashion sense and his financial means. It's like a designer handbag for your house. Just as some people buy Prada knockoffs, homeowners on a budget have known to take a Faro and Ball paint chip to a hardware store and have the color copied. What may be lost in the depth of color is gained in breadth of wallet. When David Cameron, the conservative former prime minister who led Britain into the fateful Brexit referendum, installed in his garden a shed in which to write his memoirs, its exterior was painted with a Faro and Ball shade called Mouse's Back. The Guardian, noting that the shed had cost some $30,000, mockingly described the color as an affluent hue. If Faro and Ball had existed in France in the 18th century, it would have been Marie Antoinette's first choice for decorating the Petit Trianon. In the 24 years that Studholme has worked for Faro and Ball, its palette has spread across the wealthier districts of London. In Peckham, a formerly gritty area of the city, now filled with microbreweries and artisanal butchers, clients favor bold colors like Redigio, a dark red, or Studio Green, a bilious black. In Notting Hill, which the investment banking class is taking over, the prevailing preference has been for gray. Pavilion gray, lamp room gray, plummet, in ever-increasing degrees of modernist coldness. Studholme has no formal training in design, and before joining Faro and Ball, she worked in a television advertising. She has a throaty voice and an intimate, emphatic manner. "I am passionate about people being informed about color," she told me. She and Charlotte Cosby are the authors of How to Decorate, which declares that choosing paint hues should be an adventure as well as a voyage of self-discovery. They also have a new book, Recipes for Decorating, which is out this month. Studholme estimates that she assesses more than 4,000 rooms a year. She has revisited some London homes 5 times to refresh or reinvent a color scheme. According to the experts, one is supposed to redecorate every 6 years or so. On occasion, she knows a house better than the confounded homeowners seeking her guidance. She recalled, "Oh, one lady said to me, 'I only moved in 4 days ago.' And I said, 'Oh, I know, I only moved out 4 days ago.'" She had just done the color scheme for the person selling the house. On another occasion, she was summoned to a familiar address in Surrey, her childhood home. Studholme is typically recommended by word of mouth, which means that she enjoys a run of projects in the same neighborhood or social circle. For a while, she kept getting commissioned by young women married to Premier League football players. These clients were insecure about which colors to paint their wine cellars, screening rooms, and private hair salons. "It is really just nurturing them through it," she says, saying, "Listen, you can do that," Strodom told me. Soccer wives, she discovered, often want to paint a room completely black. To answer just such a whim, Faro and Ball has introduced Pain Black, named for the color of an old prayer book's leather cover. Studholme also had a
jag of consultations on Fournier Street in the East End, a beautifully preserved stretch of early Georgian houses with handsome wooden doors, window frames, and exterior shutters. These houses were originally built for a well-to-do textile merchants. In recent decades, they have been colonized by contemporary artists, including Gilbert and George and Tracy Emin, and by homeowners with enough money to collect work by such artists. On many Fournier Streets, houses, the exterior woodwork, which elsewhere in London would be white, is covered in sensual shades of teal and eggplant. Other clients find Studholme through public appearances, such as one that she made recently at Farrow & Ball's Chelsea showroom to introduce 9 new colors. The showroom is on Fulham Road, a thoroughfare with an abundance of shops that delight the homeowner with means. A studio dedicated to carpets and taxidermy from which one can buy a Persian rug and a coordinating stuffed ibis. An outdoor flower stall at which, on that particular winter evening, a latter day Eliza Doolittle was clipping fronds of eucalyptus for fragrant bouquets. Inside the Farrow & Ball showroom, a few dozen chairs had been set up in rows. They were occupied mainly by young couples, their well-groomed heads leaning together as they studied paint cards. Standing before the crowd, she showed slides of houses that she'd worked on. Haley Almond's house was prominently featured. "The taste for shades of gray, which has prevailed for the past decade, is in decline," she announced. "We have gone through this stage of everybody going over to the dark side," she said with a slight shudder. "Today's most stylish homeowners," she said, "were embracing brighter, warmer colors." This shift, she suggested, was not merely cyclical. "When the world is in a bit of turmoil, as it is at this moment, we all want to take a bit of comfort." She said, "We want colors that will nourish our homes and nourish our souls." One such shade, she said, was Treron, an olive green named for a species of bird that is similar to an English pigeon, but with greener feathers, as if a member of the flock in Trafalgar Square had committed an indiscretion with a parrot. Farrow & Ball is produced in Dorset, in the southwest of England. I visited the company's factory, a converted slaughterhouse outside the market town of Wimborne, in December. Simon Downey, the production manager, told me, "We do small batch process," as if he were discussing artisanal coffee. To create white base paint, dry ingredients are measured by hand into drums, filled with filtered water. Everything is then combined with what look like enormous cake mixer beaters. When the blending is sufficient, the base paint is transferred into 900-liter plastic vessels. Liquid colorant is added from an overhead dispenser, like a shot of espresso being folded into foamed milk. The color is blended into the paint for 10 minutes with a steering wheel-shaped attachment. The rounded edges prevent damage to the pigment particles. From start to finish, the manufacturing process takes 4 to 8 hours. When I was visiting, a batch of Hague Blue was being stirred to completion. The enormous vat of paint shimmered like a luxurious pool in a Turkish hammam, and I almost wanted to climb in. The paint is squirted into a pot, and a worker carefully puts on a lid. If there's any drips or scratches on the tin, that doesn't even scream premium, Downey said. In addition to making full-size pots, the company produces up to 60,000 small sample-size pots a week. These retail for about $8 each, a price low enough to encourage dabbling. The company recommends that instead of daubing the contents of a sample pot directly onto the walls, customers paint 2 coats on a stiff card that they can hold up all around the room, including in dark color corners. This ensures that they will know how the shades look in a wide variety of light conditions. It's the painter's equivalent of using a dressing room mirror to see one's rear view as well as one's composed head-on appearance. As with clothes for the human body, house paints were functional before they became decorative. 500 years ago, wealthy homeowners would have announced their taste and economic resources with wood paneling or tapestries on their walls rather than paint. Interior plastic walls were commonly painted with chalk-based distemper. When colors were used, they were made from natural materials, such as clay.
Much of the color spectrum was simply unavailable, except for those who could afford lapis lazuli, which was used only in small quantities by fine artists. Blue paint didn't become an option until the 18th century, when a German paint manufacturer stumbled upon the iron-based formula for Prussian blue. Before the 19th century, colored paint tended to be used only in grand homes, and it had to be manufactured on-site by a skilled artisan. According to Patrick Beatty, a historian of paint and the author of The Anatomy of Color, The Story of Heritage Paints and Pigments, it was standard for a single shade to be used throughout a house. Pre-made commercial paints emerged in the 19th century, but their manufacture was messy and noxious. Lead, a principal ingredient, gave an excellent cover and finish, but it was also toxic. Beatty, who sells a line of heritage paints at a shop in Chelsea, cites a description from Robert Tressel's 1914 novel, The Ragged Trousered Philanthropist of a Victorian Paint Store. Quote, "The atmosphere was cold and damp and foul with sickening odors of the poisonous materials," end quote. Farrell and Ball produces a virulent shade of mint green, arsenic, which is named for the ingredients once commonly used to achieve such a hue. By the first decade of the 20th century, commercial production of paint had become widespread. In 1946, an industrial chemist named John Farrow and an engineer named Richard Ball began manufacturing paints in Dorset. They made a small array of oil-based paints with humble names such as Red Oxide. The paints were admired, but the business declined after rivals took advantage of advances in the technology of vinyl and acrylic emulsion paints, which dry quickly and are easy to apply. Farrell and Ball, expensive and old-fashioned, seemed destined to dwindle into oblivion. Then its paints caught the eye of the National Trust, a nonprofit conservation society. Well, I'm sorry we've run out of time for today's broadcast, and I'll have to cut that story short. I hope you've enjoyed listening to today's broadcast as much as I enjoyed reading it. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Today's broadcast, as well as all previous New Yorker readings, are available as podcasts at our website, triangleReadingService.org. For comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Well, that's it for today. Until next time, this is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.